So it's really a question of like sovereignty over the block space. Does the network own the block space? Does the network own these like account hotspots? Or is that something that belongs to the application that created the hotspot? So like who sort of deserves that economic value? Kind of a philosophical debate at the end of the day of who like owns the block space and deserves the economic rights to it.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Say, the blazing fast parallelized blockchain, which is unlocking Solana-like performance for the vast ocean of ETH devs out there. Now, you're going to be hearing all about Say and their new V2 upgrade, but if you take away one thing, the EVM is here to stay. There are some problems with it, which we're going to get into later in the episode, but Say, and especially their V2 upgrade, is helping solve that. So thank you very much, Say, for making this episode possible. Hey guys, big shout out to Uniswap. Uniswap is delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none. They've got a bunch of cool new features coming out, like Uniswap X, limit orders, real-time data insights. We're going to be hearing all about those features later in the program. But for now, Uniswap, thanks for making this episode possible. We'll get right back to it.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views, and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Today, I'm joined by two repeat guests, Eugene from Ellipsis and Lucas from Jito. Fellas, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having us on again.
Jinx. Guys, I'm really pumped to have the two of you on here. We're just mentioning before we got on, I think this is almost the one-year anniversary of the first Solana MEV episode that we did with Hasu as part of that MEV season, which was a ton of fun and maybe, you know, one of the strongest episodes of the season, I thought. And it felt like a really appropriate time to revisit the topic of MEV on Solana, because it feels like it's at a little bit of an inflection point in terms of the overall approach to dealing with and mitigating MEV, and is going in a very different direction than Ethereum is going. And I want to, maybe before we get into the interesting philosophical divergence that's happening right now, for folks that might be a little bit less familiar, I think many listeners will have at least a high level mental model for how MEV works and sort of the transaction supply chain on Ethereum. Why don't you guys just give just a little bit of an overview about what is sort of the some of the critical differences in between the Ethereum transaction supply chain versus how things work over in Solana land?
I can take a stab here and then Lucas can correct me on anything I'm wrong about. I think there's a few big differences between, let's call it Solana block building and Ethereum block building. The first big one is where transactions get sent to by default. So in the Ethereum world, previously, the vast majority of transactions are sent directly to the mempool. These days, they're sent more to private mempools for MEV protection. This is never the case on Solana, where the default behavior has been when a user sends a transaction to an RPC, the RPC will forward the transaction directly to the leader and the next future leaders as well. So there's no like big public gossip mempool, which means there's less opportunity for direct front running or direct back running without something out of protocol building up the mempool. And then the other really big difference in my mind is continuous block building versus discrete block building, where under MEV Boost today, and even without MEV Boost, the default behavior for block building on Ethereum is effectively to let a bunch of transactions pile up in the mempool for 11.9 seconds of a 12-second slot, and then build the most valuable block possible in that last bit of time. Whereas on Solana, the default behavior is for the leader to be building the block incrementally, continuously, as transactions are coming in. And so this trades off building the theoretically most optimal block with pre-confirmations for users by default, partial blocks getting streamed out to other validators. And one big engineering difference here is the cost to build and propagate and replay the block is actually somewhat significant relative to the block time. So if you were to build the blocks completely in a discrete way, you'll run into some computational issues and you run into some network issues trying to propagate the block and make sure it gets included.
Lucas, anything to add there?
No, I think covered it pretty well. I think the block streaming piece that he was just talking about is definitely like the much harder piece when you start to look at MEV. But I think that was pretty good overview of how that works.
Can you say more about that block streaming piece? It actually wasn't something I was super familiar with. I'm sort of loosely aware of how the attestations work in Ethereum, but what's up with the additional? Why is that where so much of the computational load and work is in Solana?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, Eugene said that Ethereum, you can basically wait 11.9 seconds and then build your block and emit it. And the entire thing is emitted on this kind of like interval, the slot time interval. On Solana, the validator is basically, every validator kind of has their own like internal, I don't even know if I want to call it a mempool, but they just have kind of their own internal state of like what the pending transactions are. And they are processed as soon as the slot starts. So like a time equals zero, they start processing those transactions and will start propagating them out to the rest of the network immediately. And it's basically doing that until it reaches 400 milliseconds or the block is full. And while that's happening, what, you know, it's processing, it's sending them out over Turbine as shreds. And while that's happening, every other RPC and validator on the network is receiving those shreds, reassembling it to the transactions and actually replaying it. So it's kind of cool. It's just like a, you know, it's like a video stream as opposed to like Ethereum. It's like kind of like choppy, like you, like on Ethereum, I guess you get like the whole like picture at once, but on Solana, you're kind of just building the picture, like the lines and the pixels are being streamed out to other validators and they're reassembling it live.
Mm. Super interesting. And, you know, maybe to, you know, Eugene underlined this point that you brought out about the, I think the discrete block building versus continuous block building is super critical, because the approach that Ethereum has largely taken around MEV is running these sorts of auctions, right? And there's sort of this principle where you want to extend out the length of time that you have to run this auction because you get more data, right? You have more view of transactions that are going on. You can build a more profitable block. I think one of the other big differences in between Ethereum versus Solana is this idea of deterministic ordering, right? The way that the fee market works on Ethereum is you can essentially pay pretty granularly to slot where you want one or multiple different transactions to fall within the block. Whereas my understanding of the way that it works mostly in Solana today is that you don't quite have that option as much, right? There's, you do have a priority fee that you can sort of pay for, but because of something called jitter, it's just, you don't nearly as much have that much granularity in terms of where you can place your transaction. And to avoid myself the embarrassment of explaining jitter, maybe Eugene, you could give an explanation of why that is and correct me if I just said anything wrong there.
Yeah, that all sounds pretty accurate to me. I think one way to think about it is on Ethereum, if I send a transaction with a slightly higher priority fee than Lucas's transaction, and we're both in the same block, I am very, very likely to have my transaction land in front of Lucas's. Or if exactly one of our transactions lands, it's very likely to be mine. Whereas on Solana, with continuous block building and given the way the default block builder, or what we call the scheduler on the Solana side, the way that's implemented, you don't really have any such guarantee. So there's some combination of latency and priority fee and what we call jitter, which is sort of this randomness, which affects who lands and how early you land in the block. And so this creates an incentive to spam, because if I send 10 transactions instead of one, I'm just going to be a little bit more likely to land ahead because of this randomness factor. And so we call that jitter. And as we understand it today, there are a couple main sources of jitter on Solana today, being the network layer, as transactions are sent to the validator, in what order are they actually received by the validator? And the other is within the scheduler itself. So the block builder, because it's receiving these transactions and trying to include them and execute them continuously, There is some jitter that gets created there as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of, and I guess to comment on that, I think a lot of the focus up until like maybe a few weeks ago, public, I guess the public focus on this problem on Solana versus with respect to the scheduler. But now we're kind of seeing a lot of this move to the networking layer. And, I guess back in the last run and maybe up until like mid 2022, Solana was using UDP as the networking protocol to send transactions. And basically, people are just blasting the leader with transactions like 50 gigabits per second of like NFT mints and arbitrage and stuff like that. So they added Quick, which kind of lets you like back pressure senders, and you can do quality of service based on the amount of stake you have or other, kind of just make up whatever rules you want, but it kind of lets you back pressure people like TCP does. And now we're kind of seeing people start to, Mev searchers are pretty clever and will find ways to take advantage of things. And I don't want to go too much in detail, but you're kind of seeing people start to like abuse or take advantage of the Quick implementation.
I actually do want to get into this a little bit because just for folks who might not even be aware, like when you say networking, can you just describe what that ultimately is? And then can you also just define what Quick is? Because it feels like that's a really core component of the networking approach on Solana.
Yeah, so earlier when Eugene was talking about the transaction supply chain on Solana, basically you send your transaction to an RPC server. It can be like Helios, Triton, maybe you run your own, whatever. Doesn't it's not super important. But that will look up the current leader and then the next like one or two leaders, and it will forward that transaction to the validator over the internet. And the protocol that it uses for that is Quick. It's CUIC. It's a protocol, I think it was invented at Google. And it's basically UDP is connectionless. And then there's something called TCP, which is connection oriented. So like I have to establish a connection with you, and there's like some handshake process. And Quick is kind of like a combination of those two things where it's using UDP, but there's some connection to it. And I guess the one benefit is that it doesn't have head of line blocking like TCP does. And I don't know how important it is to get it into head of line blocking on this call, but basically, yeah, the validator uses Quick to RPC clients, and validators use Quick to communicate. And so there's a Quick server running inside the validator, which I think it's 500 unstaked connections and 2,000 staked connections. And I think the theory is that staked senders should get more priority or more better quality of service than the unstaked connections. And yeah, I think that's kind of a high level of how the Quick stuff works.
Awesome. So I want to get into maybe to just summarize the high level construction of each one of these systems, just one put up against one another. I want to start to get into sort of the pros and cons and just kind of formally define what the different approaches are that Ethereum versus Solana has taken in terms of, frankly, just dealing with MEV writ large. So on the Ethereum system, this is changing, but basically, you could very simplistically think about it that all of these transactions, they're happening in DeFi or whatever, get sent to this public mempool that everyone can see. Various specialized actors called searchers put those things into bundles. They submit them to a builder, which goes through a relay, and then ultimately that gets signed by a proposer and then propagated to the network. And the defining characteristics of this system, at least from my perspective, is this sort of idea that MEV is going to happen no matter what. The trade-off of everything being very democratic and out in the open is that users end up getting some like front run, basically, front run and back run, which is called sandwiched. So even though we like this idea of transactions being public, although I will say more and more transactions are moving towards sources of private order flow, the negative externality of that is that users ultimately end up getting taken advantage of. And the way that Ethereum has dealt with this is to return that MEV to initially proposers, right, to validators. So it's like, okay, well, not great for users of the network, but ultimately it's going to go to proposers. More recently, through things like order flow auctions, it's being returned actually to users. Solana, it looks like, is taking well, there's very different construction of the protocol. There isn't a public mempool pool. Everything just gets forwarded to the leader. But one of the disadvantages of the approach that Solana is taking is, you know, some of the negative externalities that the Ethereum approach sought to avoid, which is spam. And then also, maybe we can talk about this a little bit later. Because spamming is very important to being able to land arbitrages and things like that on chain, then there's a huge push and incentive towards minimizing latency, which can lead to co-locating services, things like that, which we decided that probably wouldn't be good for the overall health of the network or the fairness of the network writ large. So it looks like, you guys tell me, like from my vantage point, it looks like, there were a lot of reasons to be not super happy with the approach that Ethereum has taken towards MEV. I think it's just a really tricky, thorny problem. There's no good one way to do it. The biggest criticism of the ETH approach to MEV is that the user seems to come last, I think, in many of these situations, or they have for a long time. And Solana, it seems like it's taking another approach here, putting the user first. So Lucas, maybe I can segue this right after to you to talk about why Jito is discontinuing its mempool. But, you know, my follow-up question to you guys is going to be, then how do we mitigate some of these negative externalities that Ethereum is trying to avoid, namely the spam and the co-location? So maybe Lucas, you could talk a little bit about how, like, am I viewing this sort of ideological divergence correctly? And then maybe we can get into the whole mempool part of Jito.
I think so. I think, like, Ethereum is starting to move to this thought process, or I don't know what you want to call it, but like, they don't really, like, no one's really going to be executing anything on the L1, or they, you know, they're kind of pushing everything to these L2s. And I feel like if you look at like the Ethereum blog posts and the way that people talk, they don't really ever talk about the users. It's kind of just like ultrasound money and, like, you know, whatever narrative they're trying to push, whatever the flavor of the week is. And I guess the common theme is that there's not really any focus on the user. And so, I think like Solana, there's definitely different network dynamics where I think this can work. Like the decision that we made, which I'll get into in a bit, is like, I think it will work. I think the network is like small enough and has seen enough shit that people like have a lot of stake in seeing the network succeed. And so I think that, you know, there's the validator set's much smaller. There's a lot of branded validators that have a reputation. And I think that the dynamics are just different. And also Solana has something to prove. And that is that it's the best place to build. It's the best place to do execution. And it has a very bright future ahead of it. And I think ignoring users is not going to be a successful strategy. Like, we haven't really seen any PBS or like front running on L2s. Like, why do you think that is? It's because they actually care about the users and they want to see people stick around. And no one's going to interact on L2 if they're getting screwed over. Jito had this product called the Mempool. It was like one of the first things we built in, like, started building in like beginning of 2022, and basically let you see transactions before they're executed. We released it from the very beginning, you know, when we had like 3% of stake, started growing to 20, 30. DeFi was kind of dead for a while. And then all of a sudden in like December, there was a massive uptick in meme coin trading and just DeFi volumes in general. Like, I think it was like the first week of December that we started seeing a lot of this. And we just started seeing like behavior that we didn't really like. And so, you know, we tried a few things to stop it. We tried to prevent sandwiching through code, but kind of ended up being this cat and mouse game where people were going around it. And we realized that it would have been like a really hard and tricky game to play from an engineering standpoint, but also operationally. So we decided to shelve that. And then we tried a few other things, but basically decided that, you know, we should probably be spending our time focusing on more positive things. And so we ended up just disabling that product. And yeah, I mean, I think the it wasn't like an overnight decision. We talked to a lot of people about it. And, you know, we've been talking about it and trying to do something since December or January. But overall, I mean, I think it seems like the feedback from the community is super positive. And the MEV tips, like last week, I think we were like a few hundred sol from breaking our record for the amount of MEV tips going through the system, even when the mempool is enabled. So there's still a massive appetite for MEV and getting into the block fest on Solana. I think we're actually doing more Validator tips than Ethereum now, doing around $1 million a day. So it's pretty cool to see that too. Like, you know, we ate a lot of shit for the for 2022 in the first part of the year. But yeah, pretty cool to see that. And then, you know, we're also seeing massive adoption in the network, even since we disabled the mempool. So I think we're at like 64, 65% of stake. Today, we're right around 71% of stake.
That's awesome, man. That is phenomenal. I've got a lot more questions for you, actually, just to follow up on that. But Eugene, I wanted to get your take on everything that Lucas said about just putting the user first and maybe your comment on the sort of ideology and different approach and direction that Solana is taking to Ethereum here.
For sure. I mean, I think the problem space is pretty different. There's no apples to apples comparison here, but at a high level, I view Ethereum as, from a cultural standpoint, really emphasizing incentive compatibility. You see a lot of the narrative around PBS, and the reason for PBS to exist is around centralization of stake and stake flowing to whoever is going to be able to offer the highest APYs. So with something like PBS, you're going to be able to roughly equalize the staking yields across different validators, unsophisticated and sophisticated validators. So really helping to equalize the solo staking opportunity. And Solana has a very different approach, which is to prioritize the user experience over all else. I think we've seen that a couple of different times. The Jito decision is one that's quite obvious, where, you know, users who are playing some of these shitcoin games on chain are just really getting screwed by sandwiching, where when the user sets 50% slippage, what they're really trying to say is not that I'm really happy to get filled 50% worse than the current price. What they're trying to say is I want a market order. And once you insert front running into the equation, your market order just turns out to give you the worst possible execution. And we also see that today with Solana really focusing on these issues with the network layer and the scheduler, where the user experience on Solana has been degraded over the last few months because it's been operating at such high capacity, such high throughput. And so I think that's the biggest cultural difference. But again, the problems are quite different, where if you go back to, you know, 2020, 2019, the sort of origin story of FlashBots, just when DeFi was taking off on Ethereum, because the mempool was public, there were all these games that were getting played between these DeFi traders, some combination of arbitrage and sandwiching. And this was just happening in public. This was happening in the mempool. Besides externalities to users, there's also these externalities to the network. And the focus was on mitigating these as quickly as possible. And at that time, remember, this is in the proof of work world. There were only a handful of miners with significant stake. And they were already starting to, one, spin up their own searching operations, which would create you know, better economics for some miners over other miners. And some were already making under the table arrangements with searchers. And so I think avoiding accelerationism was a lot harder for Ethereum in 2020 than it potentially is for Solana today. And it's not to say that like everything that was accelerationist on Ethereum happened. The most high profile example of this was there was an attempt to build Reorg as a service on Ethereum, and that effectively got blocked by the social layer, even though it would have been locally good for greedy validators to participate in.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting bit of lore. Actually, you can go back on an old episode of Zero Knowledge with one of the, I believe, one of the Project Blanc guys talking about this. It's an ex-Flashbots guy that was doing that. And it was the social layer. I think the way at least he tells it right publicly on this podcast episode is that it was a DM from Vitalik that sort of got him to stop, which was the ultimate social layer. But maybe actually to maybe just because we're getting only the Solana perspective here, so to give you the ETH perspective, what I think some folks might say in response to what you guys just mentioned is that one of the other big differences in Ethereum versus Solana, even though, Lucas, those are super impressive numbers, like the amount of MEV overall in Ethereum for a long time, right, was much, much larger than Solana, and I believe is still larger today. And so I think I'd say maybe it's a little bit less about like prioritizing ultrasound money, but it's more about like they were, I know that some of the folks over at Ethereum land were extremely concerned about like the impact of latency and co-location. And very frankly, worried about the impact of spam as well. So the way that I've always understood it is like, I don't know if there's a way to ultimately arrive at some sort of Shangri-La type solution, but you know, if you don't charge, you know, I think maybe the counter argument to what you guys are describing is that yes, well, Solana is a very small community today. Ultimately, if the network is going to be successful over time, it's not going to be like that. And just saying, hey, like we shouldn't, you know, sandwich users, that's not going to work as the network ultimately ends up scaling, and you need some sort of structural, something structural in place to get people to stop doing that. So that's what I guess I'm not really still understanding in terms of the vision here for Solana. And actually, we were talking about beforehand, it looks like this is one of the things that people mentioned, Lucas, when you guys discontinued your mempool. It's like, well, this was open source, right? So what's to stop another team from just coming in and spinning this up? And I think it looks like another team has actually done that, although maybe they're exaggerating some of their metrics a little bit.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a big shout out to today's title sponsor, Say. Now, I want to talk to you guys a little bit about why I think Say is cool from a design standpoint, a big problem that it solves for ETH devs out there, and then some cool stuff that Say has coming up. The reason I like Say from an architecture perspective is, again, it's a very fast blockchain, parallelization, all of that stuff, but Say has essentially been custom building block space, which is for consumer apps and DEXs. Now, they have some very cool features which enable that. So twin turbo consensus, optimistic parallelization, Say DB, all of this stuff allows you to reduce the time to finality, make for very, very fast transactions. So if you're building a consumer app or a DEX, this is basically the blockchain for you. If you've been building in the EVM, you love the EVM, but there are some restrictions about it that don't support your app. So maybe you can't do fast enough transactions, or it's not parallelized, whatever it is, you can now take all that stuff that you built. You don't have to start from scratch, and you can build it on Say. Now, recently they've launched V2, but also public DevNet. So the way that you can follow that and keep up to date is go and follow Say Network on Twitter. All right. Thanks, guys. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none. Now, if you know the history of Bell Curve, you know I did an entire season on DEXs with Dan Robinson of Paradigm. That one was a blast. We ended up talking about Uniswap quite a bit, so I'm a huge fan of the product and team. There are three really cool new features that I want to talk to you about today. One, limit orders. Two, real-time data and insights. And three, Uniswap X. So limit orders, you guys know what those are, but now you can buy and sell 700 tokens at your price on your terms. Also, we're going to get into this later, but it's powered by Uniswap X. You don't have to pay any gas fees. Two, real-time data and insights. Now, when you log on to this Uniswap interface, you can see real-time charts, transaction logs, pool data, and project information. Looks really neat. All that information is in one place, so you're basically good to go just from Uniswap. And then finally, there's Uniswap X. You get zero gas fees, no fees on failed transactions, and you get to source off-chain and on-chain liquidity. And if you want to nerd out about the construction, I think it's really cool. There's an RFQ-based system. They farm it out to different fillers that you're getting the best execution price. So finally, if you want to go check out all this stuff, which I highly recommend that you do, click the link at the bottom of the show notes so they know that I sent you. Cheers, guys.
I still am curious about like what's the ultimate solution to like spam here and some of the negative externalities of things like co-location. Like, what's the end game?
Yeah, it's tough. I think no one really knows exactly what the endgame is going to look like here, especially if you do have significant amounts of real estate on the L1. The problem looks very different for L2s. And no one, I think, is representing this Jito decision, removing the mempool, as this thing that is, going to fix the network forever. But it does mitigate a lot of the issues that we were seeing in the first couple of months of this year. I would guess on the order of high six figures, low seven figures per day of user welfare being lost to the sandwich bots. And I think that's already, a pretty big win. It's definitely not a long-term solution if you play everything out to the equilibrium. In the long run, yeah, you probably have some construction that looks like PBS-ish. You probably have something that looks like either public mempools or private mempools, because that's like the economically most efficient thing to do, or at least more efficient than what we have on Solana today. But the barrier to getting there, I think, is a lot higher on Solana because of the throughput, because of the pace at which the network runs, compared to Ethereum, where, yeah, kind of like time is stopped for 12 seconds between each block, and that's kind of an eternity in compute time. But at the very least, this buys us some time. I think everyone realizes, you can't rely on the social layer forever. No one expects to rely on the social layer forever. But if you can buy another year or two of better user welfare, and then give some of the big brains a little bit more time to work through what some of the longer term solutions might look like, that's still a huge win for the users and for the network as a whole.
Yeah, I think just that is one thing. I think that it just feels like a really stark difference, and we'll just have to see how it ultimately ends up playing out. I think what Ethereum would say is we are thinking about the users. We're thinking on a very long time horizon that we don't want a network which is co-opted by, a couple big entities that co-locate with different validators, and they just get to land all of their transactions. And then in the long run, even though it's not great for users today, at least we're building a more equitable network. The issue with that, from where I see it, is that actually they have kind of wound up with like three builders, right, that build all of the blocks. And there are two large staking operators, it's Lido and Coinbase. And actually, interestingly, I'm not sure if you guys have heard anything about this, and I'm not sure how much I heard from one of these builders that actually, that whole assumption that users would go to where yield is highest is actually not necessarily true, and the convenience of something like Coinbase is much stickier than everyone thought it was ultimately going to be. So maybe some of the core assumptions that went into the current PBS implementation over on Ethereum weren't necessarily sound either. But those are sort of the pros and cons. The way that I see it is like they do have like Ethereum does have this very long-term oriented view, but some of the negative externalities I think we see playing out already. Whereas on Solana today, we've chosen to prioritize the users today and to not create infrastructure that's ultimately going to sandwich them, but we don't really have like a long-term solution about how to avoid that holistically in the long run.
Yeah, and on the Ethereum side today, so first of all, I totally agree with that representation that a lot of stake is not particularly sensitive to the staking yield. If you're getting 4% or 4.5%, most people or a lot of capital just doesn't care. I think one issue with a lot of these economic models, they don't actually take into account all of the preferences of the user. Like, just kind of nice to have staking within Coinbase, even if I'm paying 25% of the yield back to the Coinbase entity. A lot of capital may also have, some sort of compliance requirements that prevents them from, running their own validators or whatnot. And so a lot of the economic models sort of break down at the edges here, and what you really care about is how strong each of these incentives are, where, if the staking difference was instead of 4% versus 4.5%, like 4% versus 20%, then yeah, maybe you would see, or almost certainly you would see, a lot more gravitating towards the 20%. And so, in that sense, you could call PBS a success, where the staking rewards are close enough between all of these different types of staking opportunities, but the convenience factor is pretty big.
Yeah, the convenience factor, I feel like, is just one of these things. Frankly, it's what makes Base pretty interesting over on the Ethereum roll-up side. It's just like they have so many users. I'm sure that user flow is going to be really easy. Yeah. it's just maybe an interesting thing to think about. I've got a question for you guys, because I have a lot of trouble reasoning through this, which is, I think, like, zooming out of both of these different systems and the trade-offs that they've chosen to make, we are trying to avoid some of what we view the problem of TradFi being. Like, some of the problems in TradFi is, like, one, there's a lot of, like, regulatory capture and lock-in, right? Like, two, there aren't very many entities which are responsible for, you know, doing things like internalizing order flow, you know, matching buyers and sellers, et cetera. And theoretically, over time, that could lead to, like, pretty unfair, unbalanced practices. And I think everyone's goal, whether it's Ethereum or Solana, is to set up a system that mitigates some of these trade-offs. But it does feel like we're sort of starting to gravitate, like the laws of, you know, economics and physics are starting to pull on our networks here. And over in Ethereum land, like, we have wound up with three builders that build all the blocks, albeit we have a really decentralized, you know, proposer set. It feels like over in Solana, like, maybe what we're a little bit more okay with is, you know, we don't have this PBS separation yet. So we do have more validators, but it feels like there are more companies and maybe searchers that are kind of doing, like, mini co-located, you know, like, they're running their own validator so that they can place transactions more quickly. I guess, like, from your guys' perspective, when you really zoom out, you're like, what is the end state that we're trying to avoid? And what are we doing better here? Like, what are some of the trade-offs that you feel like are red lines that we just should not cross versus, I don't know, just, like, being totally realistic and pragmatic? Like, what are some of the maybe less, you know, ideal sort of trade-offs that we're going to have to accept that but aren't the end of the world, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I think one of Solana's strongest sells is low latency, but that kind of turns into this game where, you know, you just, over a long enough time horizon, maybe a bunch of stake ends up next to, like, the major sexes, like in Tokyo or something. So I think something I think a lot about is, like, trying to avoid that while also not slowing Solana down or, like, impacting the performance of the network so much that it loses one of the main selling points. I guess, like, if you think about MEV acceleration on Solana, like, I think the most optimal thing would probably just be, like, every leader has four consecutive slots. So you could just, like, hold all the transactions and just pack your last block with, like, all these transactions that have been delayed a lot. Obviously not ideal, and I think you know, you'd probably piss some market makers and searchers and other things like that off, but you would make a lot of money. So I think that's something that I think a lot about, is, like, how do we kind of balance those two things? Like, how do we get low latency but also not make it low enough to where you just have these large forces of gravity around economic activity on, like, the geographic scale? So, you know, something, the way that might look is, like, I guess we kind of try to avoid this right now with our block engine, where we're running 200 millisecond auctions, but that's still, like, kind of long. So maybe we can, like, bump those down to, like, 50 or 20 milliseconds or something like that on a longer time horizon. But yeah, I think that's, like, the thing I think a lot about. Kind of curious to hear maybe a different angle from Eugene.
Yeah, at a high level, I agree. I mean, at the end of the day, no matter how much research you do, the speed of light still exists. Economies of scale still exist. You know, when I think about democratizing finance, I think of that on, like, a few different angles. One of them is accessibility. And one of them is decreasing the barrier to entry. The really nice thing you get by lowering the barrier to entry and lowering the barrier to innovation is you increase competition, which, not in all cases, but generally improves the end user outcomes. And so what we do see in TradFi today is there's a lot of capture. You know, you have these entities that have spent tens of billions of dollars in R&D, and they want to protect those investments, and they're in these pretty entrenched positions, and it's very difficult to compete with them. And that's the type of thing we'd like to avoid in crypto to the extent that it's possible. And I think, like, again, going back to the Ethereum side of things, the goal of PBS was to democratize access to MEV to all proposers, so the less sophisticated as well as the more sophisticated proposers, because we know there's centralizing forces there. And the goal explicitly was to move that force from the proposer layer, the validator layer, the consensus layer, over to this new block builder layer. And I don't think anyone really thought that you're going to have, you know, 20 competitive block builders, each with like 5% market share. There's just a bunch of centralizing forces here, but at least they're not on the validator layer. And even today, we're already seeing these forms of entrenchment by these block builders, mostly in the form of private order flow. So there's like two types of private order flow. One of them is order flow that a builder generates themselves. So this is a builder that's doing their own searching, or perhaps, you know, someday like Coinbase or Binance wanted to start up a builder, they send a lot of transactions on the network. So that's sort of their own order flow that they can choose to keep for themselves. And then there's this other type of private order flow, which is coming from the external world. I believe the biggest sources today are like some combination of these private auction-like things like MEV Boost, MEV Blocker, as well as from the Telegram trading apps. And that is a little bit more worrying to me, because that really does increase the barrier to entry on the block building side, where if the top three block builders have access to this flow, and that's organized through these, I don't want to call them like backroom deals, but very non-public deals, a new block builder is not really going to be able to compete with them. And in fact, like the more market share you have, the easier it is for you to give better guarantees to some Telegram trading app that you're going to be able to include their transactions in a timely manner. It's going to be less costly for you to do that. So there are some, let's call them economies of scale there. And then, of course, there's this verticalization, which, again, relates to the speed of light, where because the speed of light exists and it is not infinite, you get this verticalization and co-location between the searching layer, the building layer, and the relay layer. And if we really care about lowering the barrier to entry and increasing geographic decentralization, that's just something you're always going to have to fight against. And at the end of the day, the network values do have to come into play here, because the most economically efficient system is going to be one, even if it is on a blockchain, it's like everything is in the same data center to lower the latency as much as possible. And there just has to be this value of geographic decentralization. And at some point, the network has to decide in some way that this is a strong priority.
I agree with you on that. I think that eventually, like, the early wave of adopters in crypto are very ideologically driven for good reason, right? Like, and that's what has created so much staying power, such a strong community, et cetera. But ultimately, there needs to be some sort of market value to the decentralization that we're creating here. Otherwise, like, most of the world isn't ideologically motivated, right? Like, we need people to actually use this because they have a selfish reason to do that. I do think that exists, though. Maybe a dumb or a contrarian take that I don't really wish, but, like, you know, it would take like one government crackdown to sort of show you the value of this. And it could be this Overton window shift and everyone just wakes up like, oh yeah, this isn't a nice to have. It's a need to have. So I agree with you on that, Eugene. I think that's.
Yeah. I think censorship presence is very important to the network, but the users are not going to care about it until they're getting censored. And then from the network layer, at that point, it might be too late. So you might have to do things that are a little bit unpopular, or, you know, the people who care the most about the users today would disagree with from a prioritization perspective, but hedge against some of these tail risks down the road.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the just what's going on the UX of Solana right now. So I feel like, you know, the amount of activity that's happening on Solana has exploded recently. You guys would know that better than anyone, certainly more than me. And I don't know, maybe you have some statistics or something off the top of your head, but it, you know, it feels like Solana is actually winning in terms of things like DEX volumes, even like transaction fees that are landing on chain. I saw surpassed Bitcoin or got very close to Bitcoin, which is pretty nuts. But one of the side effects of that, which is maybe slightly less good, is the UX has been impacted here. So there have been more failed transactions. It's taking longer for transactions to succeed. The fees have started to go up, and the network has become a little bit less usable in recent days. So I'm curious, like you were, I think, Lucas, you were mentioning this a little bit. There was a debate between, I think there's the MarginFi folks and Labs about, is this a scheduler issue versus a networking issue? It seems like we've aligned on that it's a networking issue, but yeah, what's, I guess, in your guys' mind, what's driving some of the degradation in UX on the Solana side of things? And like, do we have a fix?
Yeah. So yeah, there's been an insane increase, like record volumes. There's a lot of meme coin activity. And, you know, which at the surface seems like pretty insane, but if that's like what people are doing on your network, then you need to, you know, make sure you're taking care of them. And so I think last time I looked, validators were getting around 50,000 packets per second, 50,000 transactions per second. And, you know, blocks are like roughly, I think they're like a few hundred or like 1,000 non-vote transactions. So there's not enough block space. There's a few things that are going on right now. One is kind of looking at this networking layer a little closer and figuring out how to make it perform better. There's some scheduler changes that are coming up in 1.18, which is the next software release, which should be live in like the next 1 to 1.5 months, which basically the schedulers changed to have less jitter and respect the priority fees more. So I was actually like, if you look at blocks now and you like order, if you look at the priority fee throughout the block, it's basically random. I looked at some of the blocks where there's some canaries that are, you know, with a very small amount of stake running 1.18 with this new scheduler. If you look at those blocks, the priority fees are nice and ordered. So I think, you know, fixing the networking layer, fixing scheduler is huge. There's a lot of discussion around fees. I think I've been a part of like 20 different conversations, very heated conversations around fees. you know, does Solana need dynamic base fee? What does that look like? Things like that. We're trying to help out with some of our infrastructure as well. At Judo, trying to, I think we have capacity to help out kind of speed these transactions up. So providing people that infrastructure and things like that. But yeah, I mean, these are all like, obviously in a perfect world, these things would be working perfectly and everyone would be happy. But Solana is like hitting some massive growing pains. And so I think it's good problems to have and shows that people want to use Solana and people are excited about trading on it.
I want to, just because I've been pushing a little bit on the Ethereum side of things, I do want to push back on some of these takes that I've seen where it's like, oh, you know, Solana is a meme coin chain, sort of looking down at it as being illegitimate. Like a lot of meme coinery that used to happen on Ethereum, and I didn't see anyone pushing back saying that was a legitimate activity back then, you know? So yeah. I feel like that's not a very fair criticism that I've seen come out. So I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. If you go to, I think it's analytics.soulscan.io. Okay. If you scroll down, they have a chart showing the number of new tokens per day. And let's see. Back in like December, you know, there's maybe 500 or 1,000. Today, there's been 7,000 so far. We peaked a few days ago, March 15th. There was almost 10,000 new tokens launching a day.
Man, that is nuts. And you know what? I just feel like every freaking discussion that I have these days devolves into meme coins. I don't really want to give a take on meme coins, but I do think it's indicative of like where new activity is happening. Like, I just don't think you could look at this any other way that this is extremely positive, that this is happening on Solana, and probably a pretty good indicator of like when new users come, where they're ultimately going to land, right? Like, it feels like this is a good forward-looking indicator for who's going to end up acquiring more new users this cycle. So
for sure. Yeah. I mean, this is like a pretty crazy metric. And then one more I'll share is this is DeFi Llama Solana volume. And yeah, you can see like, you know,
let's go.
Roughly $200 million a day in November. And then, you know, a few days ago it was hitting like above 3 billion. Looks like we're right around 1.5 billion today. So there's just been this crazy uptick, and you know, good problems to have, but it's also starting to stress some of the engineering and potentially economics of Solana.
We call that a champagne problem, but yeah, also a real problem. What do you guys think? You know, I would be curious to get your take. And Eugene, you're at our office as a, it might have been a couple months ago, we were talking about Solana fee markets in general, but it does feel like that there's kind of this debate that was brewing, now is maybe like moving a little bit more into the fore and talking about doing some sort of fee overhaul on the Solana network. Like, you know, ultimately now everyone talks about 1559 within the context of the burn and tokenomics and stuff like that. But originally it was really intended as a UX upgrade for Ethereum, right? Like before that, Ethereum has obviously much higher fees than Solana. There was essentially a first price auction. I don't know if you guys remember interacting on Ethereum back then, but it was impossible. It was like, you know, you had to place an order, some amount of gas, you just guessed that. Most of the time it didn't land. You found out 10 minutes later, you're like, God damn it. You know, like, what am I? So originally 1559, even though now it's always gets touted about like the tokenomics, there's really just a UX upgrade. And I think the question is like, is Solana going to get one of those eventually? And maybe dynamic base fees, just like 1559, would be a part of that. Eugene, what's your take on the, maybe you could summarize some of the debate that's happening internally in the Solana camp for folks who aren't as in the weeds as you are.
Yeah, so the fundamental thing that's happening is the demand for block space exceeds the supply of block space. And so you need some mechanism for allocating the block space among that demand. And so like one very natural thing to do is increase the price until you've equalized supply and demand. Obviously, you would also like to increase the amount of block space, but you can't do that forever. And so, yeah, there's this like big UX effect on Solana today. I think basically all the arguments you see on Twitter about Solana's failed transactions are wrong. There's a lot of nuance here. The first piece is that there's multiple types of failed transactions. So when you send a transaction to the network, let's say it's like 6 months ago, you're just transferring funds from one address to another. You sign the transaction, send off to the network, and you know, less than a second later, you hear back from the network. It's like, okay, you're good to go. You paid like 1/100th of a penny. And now what happens is a lot of times your transaction just never makes it on chain. Because again, the demand exceeds the supply, which means plenty of transactions never show up. So there's that type of failed transaction, which is the user sends it off, they wait for a minute, and they just like never hear back from the network. Essentially, like you send your transaction off, and then it just like disappeared into the ether. And then there's this other type of failed transaction, which is your transaction landed on chain, but the state change that you wanted did not occur. This would usually be some type of trade where you're buying some meme coin, you set a 10% slippage, and then by the time your transaction hit the scheduler and was scheduled for execution and made it into the block, the price had moved enough such that your trade doesn't actually go through. And it is really difficult to observe the former, because you can't, like, if all you're looking at is public chain data, you will never be aware of all these transactions that have been sent out that just never made it to the ledger itself. And so only like RPC providers and validators have access to this data. And then, of course, a lot of those transactions that are coming in, if there's 50,000 of them, I assume a bunch of them are these like spammed arbitrages and NFT mints when those are happening. And, at Ellipsis Labs, we're application developers and we have some amount of users. And when it's really difficult for users to land the transactions, it means our application UX is a lot worse. It means the users are complaining all the time. And the only lever that app developers today have to pull is increasing the priority fee. And because this mechanism doesn't work particularly well with the current scheduler, it's not very effective. And what ends up happening is the application developers just like continue to increase the priority fee. So massive UX degradation. And at the end of the day, in the same way that the meme coin traders just want to place a market order for some meme coin, the vast majority of users just want to know, hey, Solana, just tell me how much it's gonna fucking cost to land my transaction, and then I'm gonna decide if I'm gonna pay it or not. And if I decide to pay it, you're gonna include my transaction really quickly. And for something like this, you are gonna need some type of fee model, whether it's enforced by consensus or not, where you're really giving the choice back to the user in terms of are the transactions going to make it on chain or not. And so I view the scheduler issues or the fee issues as separate than the networking layer issues. I think there's like pretty significant room for improvement on both sides, and there is progress being made on both sides. But even if you had a perfect networking layer, at the end of the day, when the demand for block space exceeds the supply, you're going to need some sort of mechanism here. And one very natural thing to do looks sort of like 1559, where we can toss out anything about the burn. The real important piece there is this natural fee escalator, where if you're seeing a bunch of blocks that are really full, that probably means that the market price or the market clearing price for the fixed supply is actually higher, and so you need to increase that price. And if you can do that in a predictable way, then you can deliver the UX that we want to have. And this is the basis behind one of the proposals that is out there to implement an in-protocol fee model. It's a little bit different from 1559 because there's not just a global block space limit of 48 million compute units or gas units per block. There's also a per state, per account compute limit. And so this proposal that's out there, which is called SIMD110, implements this sort of local fee market where you have to pay for each account that you touch in a transaction, and the amount that you pay is based on prior utilization of those accounts. And I think in an ideal world, you would implement it both at the per account layer as well as the global layer, because again, the demand is just like really, really high relative to the supply today. And you are going to run into some UX issues here no matter what, because from the end user perspective, I think the vast majority of user demand is really insensitive to whether the price to land on chain is, 1/100th of a cent versus 1 cent or maybe even versus 10 cents. And the folks you're going to price out here are going to be the spam bots, which I think is still a pretty good outcome. But I think if activity stays as is, basically no matter what sort of fee mechanism you put in, the fees are going to be higher than they were 6 months ago. And that's just a function of the demand increasing.
So, how similar, Eugene? I think back in whenever we did this research hang in the office, people were talking about something called PRAWs, which were program rebatable account write fees, which is sort of similar, right? It addressed this idea that you can basically write lock any number of accounts now for free or up to like 64 or something crazy like that. And this would be an automatic payment for doing that, which then the owner of the account could choose to rebate. I mean, is this sort of a similar type idea? And do we need to fix something with, because basically what it sounds like you're saying is that for the way the base fee gets set in 1559 over on Ethereum, it's sort of a, there's a global, you're not doing pricing based on discrete pieces of state or anything like that. It's just this very global sort of unit of account, which has sort of pros and it has cons as well. Like you can make the argument that just because NFT mints are popping off, that shouldn't really impact DeFi activity and vice versa. So yeah, sorry, that was like five questions in one. But is this basically just a more, it's almost like, should listeners be thinking about this as sort of the 1559 base fee, but you can be much more specific based on the type of state that's being impacted? Is that the long and short of it?
Yeah, that's exactly the way to think about it, where the gas model in Ethereum is such that you're basically trying to price all the resources, all the limited resources of the network into a single dimension that we call gas. Now, technically, there are multiple dimensions with the blob space markets as well.
Yeah.
Which operate on a different or a very similar model, but like separate, completely separate from the gas market. And on Solana, there's, you know, many millions of accounts, many millions of pieces of state. And this proposal would be to implement this type of market on every single one of those pieces of state. And that's done, at least in this proposal, at the network layer, or like a Solana-wide enforced by consensus type of deal. And the PRA proposal that you're referring to, which came from Mango Markets, I believe in like December of 2022, so quite a while ago, is more to put that fee decision in the hands of the application developer. So the application developer will say sort of like, hey, I own this piece of state and I'm going to charge anyone who touches this state some fee. And then the idea behind that was, if you're some sort of DeFi application and you're seeing a lot of these spam-like transactions that are coming through, maybe a lot of them are failing, you still want to charge the failed transactions that are eating up this block space, eating up this limited resource. And then rebate, that's the R in PRA, to who you think the good users are. So like one naive implementation here would be, I'm just going to charge $1 to everyone who touches the state. And then if later down the road I decide like, oh, these were like real users, people interacting through the UI, their transactions succeed rather than fail, I'm just going to rebate that back to them. So their effective fee paid for the state is zero or negligible. Whereas these spam bots, I'm going to make this opinionated decision to say, this is like a bad use of the block space, I'm not going to rebate you. So it's really a question of like sovereignty over the block space. Does the network own the block space? Does the network own these like account hotspots? Or is that something that belongs to the application that created the hotspot? So like who sort of deserves that economic value? That's actually something that Canto experimented with, rebating the gas to the application developer some portion of the gas that their application use. I think it's an interesting model, and it, you know, is kind of a philosophical debate at the end of the day of who like owns the block space and deserves the economic rights to it.
Well, it is a philosophical debate, but I feel like it also is sort of an important debate that might end up coming sooner rather than later. And one thing that at least I've started to hear sort of like rumblings about is the possibility of Solana L2s as well. And I haven't actually confirmed this with the team, but I saw that like Zeta Markets very quietly just launched or announced that they were launching an L2 on Solana. But I'd be curious if what your guys' thoughts are, maybe less on, I don't know, like general purpose L2s on Solana don't make an enormous amount of sense to me, but maybe app specific L2s for exactly the reason that you're describing there, Eugene. Less of a, you know, in Ethereum, we have L2s because gas fees are so high on the L1 that you needed basically to move a whole bunch of that compute essentially off of Ethereum main chain up to this other sort of area. But maybe the other sort of reason why you might want to do that as well is you just have a lot more granular control over your block space and the economics that you create. And it does feel like there is an incentive maybe for applications on Solana to do the same thing. And they'd be motivated not necessarily by cost or speed, which is already really great on Solana main chain, but maybe I could see app developers that are interested in having more sovereignty over the economics that they're creating, or I don't know, additional aspects of control, something like that. I mean, have you guys heard any rumblings about this, or think it makes sense, or you wouldn't be supportive, or what do you think?
I haven't seen much beyond the Twitter discourse about Solana L2s. I think it's more of a gut reaction to it seems like there's not enough block space, and one way to create more block space is through an L2. I think, well, I haven't thought about this too much, but my initial reaction is it doesn't make too much sense. If you are going to go build an L2, you want a really good settlement layer that gives you guarantees around things like, when I need to post my transaction, I can post them. You need the network to be up like actually 100% of the time instead of 99.9% of the time, so you can like post your new state routes and your state transitions. And there, I think because Ethereum has been, well, really for quite a few years now, focusing on being the most robust settlement layer. It probably makes the most sense to either settle there or settle to Bitcoin, which also has a lot of pretty strong guarantees, very easy to reason through compared to Solana, where like if you're building an L2, you actually don't need the settlement layer to be particularly performant. There are some cost implications for sure, but Solana's huge advantage today is on performance and speed, and sacrifices some other things to get there. And for like a settlement layer, I don't think you need the performance and speed that Solana operates, that Solana provides.
Can I challenge that a little bit though? Because one thing that I have at least thought about is, so right now, one of the things that people are very interested in on Ethereum is this idea of base sequencing. And I think there are a couple of reasons to be interested in that, which is one, I think there maybe is a little bit of worry from the Ethereum, the asset side of things, like, hey, no one uses us for DA anymore. And is that really enough to, for number go up technology for ETH the asset? Like, I don't know. So the idea of like there being additional lock-in by using Ethereum itself as a sequencer. But I think the other reason why people are excited about it is because Ethereum is like there are 12-second block times, right? And interop is a massive challenge from L2 to L2. That it actually is, it would be nice in terms of fixing some of these interoperable problems, but the problem is Ethereum itself isn't super performant, whereas something like base sequencing on Solana would be. And so what you end up having to do is these like shared sequencer networks, and like you could make this argument that you're basically creating another Ethereum on top of Ethereum, and it's like, man, there's so many layers to all this, right? Whereas honestly in Solana I could kind of see it like, well, actually the block times are really fast, right? It's like 200 millisecond block times. Like honestly, you could probably just route something right down to Solana and back up to another L2, and it would be hardly noticeable. And maybe actually liveness is not the thing to be optimizing for, and instead the performance of the L1 is kind of critical. I don't know. Like I this is just something you've definitely thought about this more deeply than me, but I could see that argument happening as well.
Yeah, the interop problem for L2s is really cursed right now. I think it depends a lot on if you're a ZK L2 or an optimistic L2 because of the time to finality. So for example, if you're an optimistic L2 on top of Solana, and you still have some like fraud challenge window before which you commit to the state being finalized, you're not going to get any of the performance benefits doing some sort of interop here by going back to the settlement layer, because you're still going to have to wait for the state to be finalized before the other L2 will like accept this, or before the other L2 like should accept this. And the only way you're going to get that is through some sort of shared validity, which is basically like taking multiple L2s and making their validity depend on each other, which is basically like building one big L2. And this is going to be different if you are able to ZK everything in a more performant way, where, yeah, once you are able to post back to the settlement layer, then everyone can treat it as finalized. But I think the tech to do that in a performant way is just like not really there yet. The primary bottleneck is the prover cost. So for an optimistic L2 today, you basically pay for two things. You pay for DA and you pay for settlement. And then, yeah, like the sequencer costs some amount to run, but it's, let's call it negligible. And the DA is the biggest cost here. And with the ZK L2, you also add in this prover cost, which is linear in transaction. So it's actually like relatively expensive. And those numbers are coming down like really, really dramatically. So maybe in a couple of years, those will be ready. But if the goal is to like increase the amount of block space available to Solana-like things or things that need access to the Solana state, the optimistic version is just not going to work too well.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's still early days. Very maybe it, nothing ends up amounting to anything there, and there's just been rumblings about it, but I've just started to hear people talk about it. I was curious to get your guys' opinions.
Yeah, it feels a little bit more like a narrative play than like a tech play that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, you might be right. All right, fellas, I know we got to start to wind down here in a second. Any, I don't know, closing thoughts on anything that we might not have gotten to on just Solana fees, MEV in general. I don't know, anything that we missed or stuff you want to, something that you want to leave the audience with?
Yeah, I got one. There's I think the idea is still being developed. There's a new SIMD out that I think is pretty interesting. SIMD 130, dynamic block limits. And basically like the idea is like 48 million compute units is kind of like an arbitrary number. I think the math was like a compute unit's roughly like 33 nanoseconds or something, and there's four threads, and you know, it's pretty hand wavy, but this proposal is pretty interesting. It's basically like you can potentially increase block space if the utilization is if people are using more than, I guess this proposal says 75%, you know, kind of choose a number there, but if the network's being used a lot, then you can potentially increase the block space on the network. And basically, yeah, I think it's a pretty interesting proposal. I think there's another proposal that would probably be nice here, which is timely vote credits, which Santetsu at Shinobi Systems has been leading up a lot. Basically, you get rewarded more credits if you are voting on a timely manner. And so you can imagine like it could be interesting. I think it's a pretty interesting proposal if you like start to increase the block size and basically increase it until like some percentage of the network can't keep up. And then yeah, it would be a good incentive to for validators to upgrade hardware. And just kind of an interesting discussion. I don't know if something like this has been proposed other than like the gas increasing the block size on Ethereum.
Well, shout out to the author of this particular proposal, who is Caveman Lover Boy. So,
Yeah, Mr. KV is a legend in the Solana community. I agree with like the high level here, which is again, because the demand exceeds the supply, we should do whatever we can to increase the supply of block space, but surely there's some max amount of block space that the network is able to provide at a, you know, while maintaining whatever guarantees you want to maintain around like hardware requirements or whatever else. And then the natural progression would be, okay, we'll increase the block space if it's highly utilized up until some point. And then the question is, why do we need this controller in the first place? Why don't we just increase the block space to that and leave it there, unless the goal is revenue maximization rather than UX and fees. I think like at a cultural level, Solana really prioritizes user experience. I think that's Solana's biggest competitive advantage over every other blockchain today, and Solana should never toss that out.
Eugene, what do you, one of the, I don't know, maybe design, call it philosophies or design choices or whatever, that I see. One of the biggest differences that I see between, I actually think Celestia and Solana are similar in this instance, and it contrasts against Ethereum versus Bitcoin. It's kind of like, to really drastically oversimplify, like the small, scarce blocks versus larger, more abundant blocks. And this idea, like this was famously what the block size war in Bitcoin were fought over, right? It's like, keep the blocks extremely small. And there are some desirable properties that you get out of that. You can keep really low hardware and bandwidth requirements for, the node operators on Ethereum or the node operators on Bitcoin or the proposers on Ethereum. But the downside of that is like, fees spike through the roof, right? Because you're kind of artificially constraining the amount of space that you can write to. Whereas like you could just take this totally different approach and say, like, honestly, we should be striving, like the fees shouldn't be the dynamic thing. We should be targeting extremely low fees, and we should just build out our networks of computers to accommodate for more block space. Like, why wouldn't we do that? So I guess there is some theoretical limit, right, to the amount of block space, but like, why shouldn't we just be, it's almost like the inverse of the way that Ethereum and Bitcoin think about it, which is like, keep the block size relatively static, right? It is dynamic a little bit, but like keep it relatively small and constricted. Let the fees move, but you could just like target really low fees and just have the block space sort of modulate, which is what it seems like this SIMD is saying. I don't know,
Yeah,
like where is.
I think the elephant in the room here is the value capture question, where the revenue maximizing thing for the network is not maximally increasing the block space. And then, yeah, the other piece that you touched on is the hardware requirements, where I think Solana and Ethereum, can't really speak for Celestia or Bitcoin, have very different approaches, where Ethereum has somewhat explicitly, or parts of the Ethereum community have expressed a preference for, Ethereum being World War III proof. And yeah, that means you're not going to be able to have or rely on like data centers, for example. And then it comes down to, okay, so what should be the minimum hardware requirement to be able to participate on the network? Is it like I should be able to run this, like run a validating node from a TI-84 on the moon? Or should it be like if I have a 10 gigabit internet connection and $20,000 of hardware, that's the guarantee. And like, if someone is sufficiently motivated, they'll be able to acquire that.
Okay, but let me, I guess I've had a really hard time articulating this thought, but all right, let's just play this out, right? It's World War III resistant on ETH main chain, but you get all these new super-powered L2s like Mega ETH or whatever, right? And everyone builds applications that are based on having extremely abundant, very cheap block space, right? Like the unit economics of all these businesses that get built on the L2s are based on L2 economics, not based on L1 economics. Then World War III ends up happening, and all of these centralized sequencers that are getting run out of data centers have to shut down. What the hell do you have? You have a bunch of businesses that don't make any sense based on the network. This is what I don't actually think, if you were to like really imagine a World War III scenario, I don't think the current system actually supports that. Like, yes, you would probably get some like base functionality, like you'd still be able to, transfer ETH tokens and stuff like that, and that wouldn't be disrupted, but like, theoretically, the entire value of the network would be based on the apps that are built on the network, and they'd all be built to a spec that no longer makes sense in a World War III scenario. I don't know. This has always bothered me. I feel like the logic doesn't foot.
Yeah, I think no matter what, during World War III, some stuff is not going to work as well as we hope it to.
That's true.
I think the Ethereum folks would say here, well, yeah, some of the L2s are going to get into trouble, but if the L2 is in a roughly finalized state, you will still be able to do things like force include transactions through the L1. You'll still be able to, like, transfer ETH, transfer assets anywhere around the world in not quite the speed of light, but in like 12 seconds. And there's a lot of value there still. You still be able to like use Uniswap on mainnet. Yeah, maybe the fees will be high, but it'll be better than having no system at all.
Okay, that makes sense. Let me address the point that you made about revenue and that sort of tension. How do you guys think about revenue from the, like, I guess revenue to who? Because I don't know, there's kind of it's unclear to me that we should be, I've seen a lot of people try to jam like L1 transaction fees into a P&L format, and I'm coming down pretty strongly on the side that that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think there can be intersecting sets of P&Ls around a network. Like, I think a validator P&L makes a ton of sense, right? Like, that is, it's a business. They're a service provider to the network. But Sol, ETH, Bitcoin, these are commodities. You wouldn't say, what's the P&L of oil? That's a nonsensical statement. And so I guess when you say like it's unsustainable from a revenue standpoint, from whose perspective are you talking about? Because I'm actually not 100% clear or certain on the idea that, like, you know, we need to be running this like positive P&L from a fees perspective for the network.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm not arguing for that either, but I'm just saying that the revenue maximizing thing for the network is not to maximally increase the block space. But yeah, I don't think like any of these crypto assets today are valued based on some, DCF analysis. That's like, the first like most mid-curve thing anyone does when they get into crypto is like, okay, what is the revenue? Does this make sense? What's like the PE on Ethereum? And yeah, like so I think like none of the coins trade like this today. It's unclear if that will be the case in perpetuity. And you also sort of see this pivot from the narrative side that Ethereum has been pushing for a while towards like ultrasound money narrative, which is effectively trying to turn Ethereum into a meme coin, or at least get valued as a meme coin, rather than based on the fundamentals.
Why do you think it not in, why do you think it's not revenue maximizing to increase block space?
Yeah, I didn't follow that either.
Well, there's
Right now there's 50,000 transactions that want to get included, but there's only 50,000 per second, but there's like 1,000 or 2,000 that are actually getting included. So it seems like I'm an engineer, I'm not an economist, but it seems like if you were to include those, then validators would make a lot more money.
Yeah, so it depends like how much you want to increase it. So, for example, if you increase supply to infinity, then the price becomes like epsilon, unless you have some. Well, yeah, you have some like base fee mechanism in there as well, which would have to be enforced by consensus. But at the end of the day, it depends on like the elasticity of demand, and then there's going to be some sweet spot between like price and quantity that is revenue maximizing, but it's almost never at increase the supply to infinity. So like I think it's very possible that if we doubled the block space today on Solana that the validator revenue just goes up. But I think if you 100x it, assuming that was possible, it's not clear whatsoever.
Do you guys? I know that this. So just also, I'm not a huge fan of the ultrasound money meme. I do think my framework for a long time has been, I think these L1 assets look like something like commodity money type things. And I think there's going to be a basket of ones that people ultimately end up holding and using. But do you guys, I know there's like less even appetite in Solana to talk about things like this, but do you view Sol as potentially really long, a long time down the road, like some sort of store of value, you know, unit of account, money like thing? And then I don't know, it sort of feels like there's like two ways that you could look at the business model of an L1, and one would be like you're an operating system for applications to build on. The other would be you're an exporter of a commodity money thing. And in theory, those two things should be really linked, but they're kind of not, are they? I mean, you can just look at Bitcoin, which has basically been ossified for years and years. Very few technical upgrades have been made, but obviously the export of the money has been pretty good. You know, like just look at what Bitcoin's done. And it's been pretty divorced, frankly, from much technical progress. So I don't know. I mean, I know it's kind of a high-level question, but how do you guys, what's your sort of mental model and framework for looking at these L1s in general?
I don't have any view on what is money, what is not money, certainly not in the long run. I will say one thing that is important for these proof of stake ones in particular is the economic security of the network does depend on the value of the network token. And so there is some incentive from the network perspective to do what it can to pump the token, whether that's meme it into existence or generate revenue and return it to the token holders.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that point. I think that Anatoly kind of has an interesting view on this, where like a lot of the stuff it will be somewhat commoditized in the future, like block space and things like that. And so I think viewing it from that angle is certainly pretty interesting when you compare like Solana versus Ethereum and the high fees versus low fees and trying to maximize the amount of block space on Solana. I mean, I think Sol right now it's like access to block space and MEV, and I don't think that focusing on ultrasound money is like a good thing for Solana to be focusing on.
Yeah. Fellas, I appreciate you've been super generous with your time. And I think we covered a lot of really interesting ground. If folks want to follow either one of you, find out more about the work that you're doing, like what's the best way for people to do that?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, Buffalo, Jito Labs as well. And
Lucas, what is the origin of Buffalo?
we'll s
I'm just kidding. I won't put you through that if you don't. You don't want
save it
to.
for you gotta buy me a beer to get that out of me.
Exactly. All right, we'll get the beer permissionless this year. Eugene.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at 0xShitTrader, and you can follow Ellipsis Labs as well.
Sweet. Fellas, this was a fun one as always. Maybe we'll do another one of these in a year. We'll give the big update on Solana MEV making an annual thing. But appreciate you guys.